David?
So good morning, everybody. I know it's always hard to sort of get up the last morning of a very long conference, and I'm sure you're all anxious to get home. Victor said, I direct the health program at Kresge, and some of you may know about Kresge and others may not, so I'll just give a brief description of that, and hopefully it gives you some idea of why we're interested. So we are a $3 billion private national foundation that works to expand opportunities for vulnerable populations in America's cities. But that wasn't always true. So just to give you a little background, the foundation began actually in 1924, so in 10 years we'll be 100 years old. That puts us in the range of what I call the true legacy foundations of this country. You know, the MacArthurs, the Rockefellers, the Fords. Sebastian Kresge, who founded the foundation, and Kresge, I don't, for those of you who are too young to know, eventually became Kmart, the Kmart Corporation. The foundation, though, has not had a connection with the company since its inception. But Sebastian, as you know, was a retail guy. I mean, he wasn't an industrialist or a financier or other captain of industry. I mean, he was making money on five and dime. And his approach to philanthropy followed suit. So what the foundation did up all the way through the 20th century was help nonprofits build buildings. So I will say that wherever you graduated from college, there's probably a building that with poor bricks that Kresge paid for somewhere. But beginning a few years ago, back in 2007, we began a pretty dramatic shift away from the core kind of grant making that we had been doing for, you know, nearly 100 years, from doing bricks and mortar to a more strategic kind of grant making. And so as you can see, you know, in terms of what we do, it is no longer about the sort of helping organizations build buildings, but really to improve their lives. As I tell people in audiences like this, because I speak to a lot of public health and medical kinds of organizations, we are not really a health organization or a health foundation. We work in these areas. We have an arts and culture program. This is actually not a good description of what they do, because it's really about creative placemaking. And I don't know if many of you even know about the term of placemaking, but it's this idea that, you know, places have value, and how we think and design those places influences how we interact with each other, how we move. And I think from a public health point of view, you understand that intuitively. What the arts team is saying is that arts can be a valuable way of integrating design that is both aesthetically pleasing but also enhances, you know, the community's appreciation of arts and the community and engagement in the arts. We have a Detroit program, we've been pretty busy in Detroit as of late. As you can imagine, we are deeply involved in the bankruptcy proceedings. But what people don't understand about the Detroit program, or what's going on in Detroit, rather, is that the bankruptcy is really about a municipal situation of not being able to pay its bills, mostly because of legacy costs. What's happening, though, on the ground is actually going to change the way that the city begins to think about itself and even be designed. We have an education program which is focused on post-secondary access and success. We have an environment program which is, the core word here is resilience. Here, what's interesting is that what we mean by resilience, you know, is not only about communities' abilities to bounce back in the face of changes expected from climate, but it's about how communities engage themselves in that process of planning for it. And as you can imagine, there's lots of intersections between health and the environment on this. And in fact, yesterday morning, if you got up very early at 7 o'clock, was the first meeting of the U.S. Climate and Health Alliance, which is going to be an organization sort of organized within the public health community. And we had a great first meeting. This was co-funded by both the environment and the health team. And then we have a social investment practice. So we use loans, loan guarantees, and deposits, which, again, doesn't really fully describe this particular aspect. This is not a programmatic area, but this is saying that a foundation has more than grants to give. And many of you may know or may not know that foundations have the ability not only to give grants, and that's probably the form of capital that most of you are familiar with, but we can use our balance sheet. And by that, we can take the actual assets of the foundation and use that to leverage. So what that can, at the very least, that can mean is it can mean that we can make loans to nonprofits and even government entities, and even in some cases for-profit entities if it's for charitable purposes. That's generally called program-related investments. But what's exciting right now is that our investment team, and our investment team in the sort of realm of philanthropic endowment building is considered one of the best of class. They think that the opportunity right now in the health sector, especially around social determinants, is actually becoming an investable opportunity, which is terrifically exciting. We could probably spend a whole session just talking about the possibilities there, not only for enhancing and making more effective medical care, but on the public and population health side is actually becoming really intriguing. I would have never expected it, but the ACA is actually moving the markets in that direction. And we have a human services program, which is really focused on increasing the capacity of human service agencies to build their capacity. So as you can, I just say all of that as a prelude to what how we think about health, because in a foundation that is really focused on expanding urban opportunity, we really can't define health as simply health care. We can't define it as a 1.0 or 2.0 proposition. It really has to be thinking about health broadly speaking, and in fact, health within a broader community development context. So we have two broad areas. The first we call healthy environments, which is, I think, from a public health point of view, you would understand and appreciate as simply environmental health. But really not simply the kind of environmental health that we sort of traditionally think of, but, you know, what directions and what innovations are moving this area. And one of the key innovations that we see in this area is, in fact, HIAs. And that's why we've been supportive of this from the beginning. But there's other kinds of innovations that we see happening in the environmental health space, which we see promoting. And the other we call community health partnerships, which is looking really at the healthcare system and asking how can population health or how can health be achieved, you know, through this system. So trying to really seek these transformational opportunities, especially under ACA, to move our current health system away from a medical focus, an individual focus, to a population focus. So that's really the aim of community health partnerships. Both of these are in the process of being slightly recalibrated as we move forward, and the HIAs are going to play a role in this particular rollout as we begin to think about this whole thing. Just to give you some idea that as we begin to think about the whole range of environmental health, you know, I would say the field has been characterized by a reactive kind of stance. The fact that you know, bad things are out there. People get exposed to bad things, including bad design and all sorts of other things, but certainly pollutants and other things in the environment, lack of access to food, food deserts and the like. But the reactive stance sort of misses the opportunity on the upside to sort of figure out, well, why did we get here in the first place? And that's where the question of HIAs comes in. If you think about HIAs not simply as a tool, but this is prevention at a policy level. It's prevention at a policy level. And it's prevention not only of bad policies, but it's prevention of policies, as Dick Jackson has said, of policies that are embedded in concrete. So once these policies are made, especially around land use, transportation, housing, they become embedded in the physical environment and therefore in our lives for years to come. Often for decades. They dictate not only how we move, it dictates how we get to jobs, how we live, and the overall quality of life. And those decisions don't get made every day. They get made at periodic times, and they're often the result of many, many years of planning. And What we're talking about in terms of HIA is a tool from a public health point of view to prevent bad policy. But it's also on the positive side to promote good policy, right? So policies that could advance health and that could advance good design and those kinds of things are also opportunities to use HIAs. So that just sort of is the sort of broad overview of how we're thinking about this. For those of you who may not know, the Health Impact Project at Pew Trusts, and Kresge certainly can't take credit for what's happened in the whole HIA sphere. Pew Trust has been the main implementer of the philanthropic investment in HIAs across the country. It's a partnership between the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which has put the bulk of money into this whole effort, along with the California Endowment, Kaiser Permanente Colorado, St. Luke's Foundation in Cleveland, and us. And to the extent that we have seen the advancement of HIAs in this country and the practice of it, to a great extent this has been supported by re-granting from Pew to the rest, to the nonprofit and the public health field. So this is an example of where foundations and the public health community can help advance good practice. Jonathan Heller, who Victor mentioned in his remarks, came to us several years ago. And Jonathan, who many of you probably know, or maybe if you don't know, has been really one of the pioneer practitioners of this art or science, I guess, depending on how we define it, of HIAs. And, you know, having been instrumental in the development of this particular tool, became concerned several years ago that that the success of the tool had been so much that the whole core of equity had been dropping out, that it had become kind of embedded in the normal process, you know, in the same way that sort of EIS, you know, many of you probably know about the EIS within standard like community development. So it was just simply another box to check on the way to development. And so we were missing this opportunity to really embed equity into this whole process. And when we say equity, it's not only on the outcome side, but it's also on the process and on the input side. So that is to say, it's pretty easy for the planning professionals to say we've done the health impact assessment. But what has not often happened is the community engagement part, the community participation part, and the community ownership part of this whole thing. So there's a whole level of sort of democracy and community organizing, which was always intended to be part of the HIA tool and which was getting left out of the process. The same could be said for all the other parts of the process. There were good intentions behind EIS as well, but that, again, has become so institutionalized within the process and systematized that that it really does become simply another loop to jump through rather than, you know, a real process of engaging the community. So the opportunity here and what the Pew Trust has funded and what PolicyLink and others have promoted is how to use it as a way to engage communities. So there's really what I call democracy building kinds of efforts in this effort. And the examples that are provided in the case examples in the briefing that Victor mentioned give you examples of how communities have used this not to stop development. You know, the whole point of a lot of environmental health efforts is often to stop development rather than trying to get to a point, you know, which is more win-win. Now, that's not always possible in a lot of development, but to find ways at the very least to mitigate the worst of these issues, but at the best to find solutions that culminate both in better health and a better standard of living for the people whose lives are going to be most affected by it. I think we have an opportunity at this point, actually sort of historically, if I could sort of step outside the script, as we begin to look at the field around this area to really begin to think in a very different way about environmental health engagement on this. You know, that we can really begin to think more broadly about development, jobs, and economic impact, as well as public health. And my challenge to you as public health professionals, you know, is to be engaged in the community development process, because as I mentioned, these policies are being made, you know, regularly, and they become embedded in the physical environment for years to come. And the only way to really get ahead and truly get upstream of the issues that we're all concerned about is to be involved in that process, which means you must become literate not only of HIAs, but how the community development process works, and not to feel that you are a bystander, an outsider to this process. Because embedded in the rules and policies of those things are, in fact, opportunities for community engagement. HIA is your tool. So think of it that way, that this is a way to be engaged in that process, and to give not only the public health voice, but the community voice in that process. And those are the kinds of opportunities that we need to think about, you know, for years to come. That may involve, in fact, understanding the financing part of this this angle, but that's another a whole other discussion. But it's something that we're thinking about, just because so much money is, in fact, on the table when these decisions come about, that you sort of have to understand what you're up against. Having said that, I just want to. I'll end with this story. This didn't actually involve an HIA, but it, technically, but it did. They just didn't call it that. This was in Chicago. I was actually going there on a site visit because we were working with a nonprofit, several nonprofits there, around the expansion of rail yards on the south side of Chicago. This was a huge development, right in the middle of historically African American communities. The process had been going on for 10 years to develop the expansion of these railroads. And if for those of you who don't know, Chicago is basically at the heart of the transcontinental rail system, freight system in this country. So all rails lead to Chicago. I tell people this is the first site visit where the beverage served was champagne, because that week, the city of Chicago conceded on virtually every request that the community made, because they had the data on the health, they had the Respiratory Health Association at the table, and they were able to turn the development so much so that the city of Chicago and the rail companies gave that neighborhood $1 million for green improvements in the community, plus promises to have clean engines, clean freight, even timing the stoplights on the way to the rail yards so that trucks would not be idling at every block. So I just tell you that because that so much money had been on the table for this development, and without the health impact assessment of that, this would have gone through. But this, because it was so much money on the table, that with the threat of a lawsuit, that's another tool which we could talk about, but with the threat of a lawsuit, it really told the city that this is something we need to take care of, and they did. They did the responsible thing. So I just say that because that was a huge public health victory, and it shows it can be done. So I'm going to turn it over to, is it Julie that's going to, or are you going to go back? Okay.
Thank you, David.